And from the outside in, most people wouldn't have guessed that I wasn't content with where I was professionally. Now, I was doing well financially. I, you know, had some prestige associated with some of the jobs that I've had, but none of that fulfilled me. None of that really did anything for me. It was like nice on the outside, but like, ugh, on the inside.
Yeah.
So for me, while it was something I, you know, I'd rather not have had to go through, losing my voice was one of the best experiences and opportunities of my life. Man. Yeah. Well, everything can be a good thing in hindsight. And I do mean that. I mean, if we look for it, there's opportunity to learn and grow from everything we experience, good and bad. I mean, that's a very good and bad are very subjective words. Hard to say there's something objectively good or objectively bad. It really just depends on your positioning and perspective.
Hi, and welcome to the Sunday Lunch Project Manager podcast for Sunday, the 8th of January, 2023. This is your host, Nigel Creaser, and today I'm talking to Greg Offner, the piano guy. So I hope you all had a great Christmas and festive period, or whatever you celebrated over that time. A bit of a shock for me going back into work again. I think all of us feel that way after that holiday, because it is a bit of a kickback down time, though we had quite a busy time during it. And I have straight back into our finance week. So for those who are in that project management field, when you have that month-end finances that you're going through, it's always quite a busy part of the month. But all done now from my perspective, and a few other things going on. Been looking at planning what I'm doing for the rest of the year, looking a bit more detail of some of the things I shared on my 2023 targets, and playing around with a few AI type stuff. I saw a post on LinkedIn, which I'm casting around on my desk, looking to see if it's on my desktop. It isn't anymore. I can't share the name of the person. I think I did share the post itself. And it had sort of different things of the AI world that's out there at the minute. And I played with ChatGPT, which I think appeared in the middle of December, and it's quite a lot of news coverage, whether it be in the business area or outside of that. It's quite an innovative and powerful tool. So I've been playing with that, asking what's the best project management podcast is. Didn't know mine, so maybe need some improvement on that, I suppose. Other podcasts are available. And the other thing I started playing with is a product called Midjourney, just jump into another page on my computer. And Midjourney, which is a tool which it's powered through, or the way I've been using it anyway, is through Discord. And essentially you sign up for it, get it sorted, and you put a description of what you want to be produced. And I thought it'd be quite interesting, so I had a play with it. And I've got a couple of things where I asked it for my typing is atrocious, to be honest. When I looked at it, it's got a man stood with a phone to his ear, and in the background a plane on a runway with rescue slides and emergency vehicles surrounding it, and smoke coming out of the doors. And the image I've got, which looks a bit weird in some ways, is actually, considering it's done by AI and auto-generated, it's astounding. I will share this in the show notes and on the website. But yeah, if you're into that stuff and you kind of like the idea of using it, things like ChatGPT, things like the Midjourney stuff, that ChatGPT from us as project managers, I can see how by using it, it'll be an interesting one. Generating status updates is an area I can see it becoming quite useful. You're inputting generic details of it, and it may be able to form a more, we'll be able to use it to form more concise or more better ways of giving data out there. And there's a few other on there. I think there's one called Hemingway, which I believe is one that you can drop some text in and it will recraft it in shorter, more consumable bites of sentences. So having fun playing with some of those, because I think it's one of those things we need to get as project managers, an understanding of where all of these different AI tools either are going to help us or actually we're going to be using as part of our, if you're in IT, your project deliveries. If you're in a digital area, I imagine Midjourney and things like that are going to become very significant in creating marketing digital kind of stuff and using those tools. So how do you use those tools? How do you, maybe there's some automation in there, so I can imagine people needing to use that. And then from the text side of it, a lot of it will be being used to assist us in our jobs. It's all quite clever but also quite scary as well, and that kind of leads me on to the only kind of major update, really. I suppose I mentioned it, I think, in my last podcast, but I'm going to kind of major on it a little bit more, is that I launched the audiobook of Project Manager Productivity Hacks, and I utilized the Google Play Books AI narration capability, which it took a couple hours for it to do it. There's some more editing needs to be done in it, but I've took the decision to just push it out there and get some feedback from you guys. And I've played it to a couple of people, and I'm really impressed with how it sounds. Okay, I don't know why I'm surprised at that, with the Alexa technology and all those sort of things that have been around for a while. It's not a surprise that it's capable. It's just so close to the human voice reading it, with some subtleties that make you just realise that it isn't. And it's out there. It's I'm going to be putting out one of the chapters. I've got to work out how to do it, download it, get it as a freebie to anyone who wants it, really. Probably use it to get people to sign up to my mailing list as well. But yeah, keep your eye out for that. You can have a sample of what it sounds like and see whether you think, yeah, great, you want to buy a copy of the book. And at the moment, I've got it down at around £4.99 in UK GBP and relevant similar values across the world, and available on all the Google platforms. So really wide coverage. The other little thing on that as well, I've noted that last week, in fact, Apple announced, all week before, Apple announced that AI narration was going to be enabled within their books area. So when that comes, I've got to work out how to use it. And you can do it through Draft Digital, and I'll make it available through Apple. So it will be Apple and it will be available on Android. I'm also making it available on my PayHip site, so you'll be able to download an MP3 version of it. Just paying along there. There'll be links in the show notes today. I expect the Big A, as in Amazon's Audible capability, will soon be following with that AI narration, because it just seems if the other big players are doing it, they will follow suit. That's me making an assumption. So, and when that does, it'll be available through the Apple Audible book area as well. I will at some point do a narrated version by me narrating it. It's just making sure I've got the technology to do it properly. Whilst the sound of the podcast is okay, I haven't yet trialed the latest setup that I've got from a point of view of listening for the reading, because there's certain minimum levels and levels of background noise and things like that that are accepted by the different hosts and distributors. So that's really the big things to talk about this week. And next week I'm traveling quite a bit, looking forward to that. And I suppose the only other thing is my I have narrated a little bit of, not narrated, what's the word? Dictated a little bit of my next project management related book. I've yet to pull the dictation down and see how terrible it was when I've done it. And then I can work through that. I'd like to get that out this year, if I can. And yeah, podcasts. I've got a whole raft of interviews coming up over the next 4 or 5 weeks. Fantastic guests, as they always are on the show. It'd be really good if anyone has any topics or any individuals that you guys out there would like to hear on the show. Ping me a message, or whether it be on LinkedIn, whether it be Facebook, or just an email, or via the Anchor app. If you're listening to it on Anchor, you can just click a button, I believe, and just record a message to me, which some people have done before. And let me know what you think. Let me know what you'd like to see from me in 2023. Unless it's to shut up, no, keep that opinion to yourself. But anyway, I'm going to shut up now and let you get on to listen to Greg and his fascinating story and some fascinating tips and on performance, basically. It's have a fantastic rest of your day. Cheers now. This week, I'd like to welcome Gregory Offner to the show. Gregory is a multi-talented individual with a passion for entertaining and educating others. His keynotes, workshops, and corporate consulting engagements help the world's leading organizations create high-performing and highly fulfilled leaders. Prior to this work, Greg led global sales and marketing efforts for several Fortune 100 organizations, brokered complex risk management and insurance programs for large commercial organizations, and drove process improvement initiatives as a certified Lean Six Sigma practitioner. But during that time, Greg lived a double life. And by day, he was in his suit and tie wearing professional, but at the cover of night, he was known as Junior, a world renowned professional dueling pianist. As an entertainer, Greg has performed on stages of every size for audiences on 5 continents, and his ability to integrate fun and energy into his programming, yes, he often uses a piano on stage, transforms his program from a keynote speech to a keynote experience. So Greg, welcome to the show.
Nigel, thanks for having me on. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's brilliant. So tell us a little bit about you and your background before those, your notes, your bio there, obviously. You'll recognize some of those words as I always plagiarize from my guests' websites.
Yeah, I always listen to that and I think, what idiot wrote that? And then it's like, oh yeah, me. I'm the idiot that wrote that. Like, it's way too long. I think that's way too long. So let's talk about that. So what is, I think, maybe the key takeaway for somebody, for me, who I am and what it is that I do. I had this very unusual beginning to my career in that I studied music and psychology and philosophy in school. And I know what you're thinking. You must have been beating the ladies off with a stick with that combo degree. But, you know, I really had no idea where I was going to fit into the world when I graduated. And so, like many people, had nothing to do with my degree when it came to the first job I took. I landed in a job in sales. And it turned out I was pretty good at it, because really what sales is for many people is just acting. So I joke with people and say I had actually a corporate acting job when I first started. I acted like a professional, and I guess I was pretty good because they bought it. They bought it for a long time. But in 2015, that double life you mentioned that I was leading sort of caught up to me. And acting and performing all day on the corporate stage as a sales executive and, you know, leading sales teams and whatnot, performing on actual stages in the evening, leading audiences of drunk people and sober people too, but, you know, mainly people who'd had a couple cocktails, because the more they drink, the better we sound, leading them through a night of fun and favorite songs and sing-alongs and funny bits and things. That all taxed my voice to a point that was just tremendously unhealthy. And I found myself in a situation where doctors said, if I didn't stop, if I didn't do a hard reset on some of the habits that I developed throughout my life, and if I didn't get medical surgical intervention to repair and rebuild all the damage that had accumulated on my vocal cords, I ran the very real risk of never speaking again. And that was something that for someone who uses their voice all day, that shook me to my core. That really challenged who I thought I was, the value that I thought I brought to the world. And it made me get comfortable with discomfort as I launched into then changing all of those habits and behaviors that I developed throughout my life, really reinventing in a way who I was. And so I decided to grab that opportunity and sort of juice it to the fullest. If I'm going to reinvent who I am, I ain't just going to stop with how I use my voice and, you know, my social habits. I'm going to change everything that I am not content with. And from the outside in, most people wouldn't have guessed that I wasn't content with where I was professionally. Now, I was doing well financially. I, you know, had some prestige associated with some of the jobs that I've had, but none of that fulfilled me. None of that really did anything for me. It was like nice on the outside, but like, ugh, on the inside.
Yeah.
So for me, while it was something I, you know, I'd rather not have had to go through, losing my voice was one of the best experiences and opportunities of my life. Man. Yeah. Well, everything can be a good thing in hindsight. And I do mean that. I mean, if we look for it, there's opportunity to learn and grow from everything we experience, good and bad. I mean, that's a very good and bad are very subjective words. Hard to say there's something objectively good or objectively bad. It really just depends on your positioning and perspective. So, you know, if you think your significant other's a chatterbox, then maybe losing their voice is objectively good for one and objectively bad for the other. But for me, it was that needed pause. It was a challenge. It was an element of life that I couldn't just barrel through, because that's what I sort of did. You know, I was a very determined individual, head down, sort of barrel through problems. I mean, I started out life at a military school. You know, one of my first educational experiences was in a military environment. So that really taught me a lot about resilience, about self-leadership. And it, I guess this is where it comes from, it developed within me a, not refuse to lose, but refuse to give up sort of mentality. So even though I didn't necessarily like the professional direction my life was heading in, I said, well, you know, the money's good. It'll get better. So just keep going, head down, keep driving. And there's nothing objectively bad about that decision, but it didn't fulfill me. And in many ways, that losing my voice created the opportunity in life for me to stop and find and actually stop and think about what would fulfill me. Because I'd spent a lot of time identifying, well, I don't like that. I don't like that. Okay, well, what do you like? I don't know, but I got stuff to do. I'll figure that out later.
Yeah.
Later never comes. I mean, that's, you know, some people don't learn that until they're 80 or 90 years old. And the doctor's like, hey, this is about it for you. We're going to wrap that life up. This is the end of the line for you, my friend. And then they realize all the things that they didn't pursue that they wanted. I got lucky in that, you know, for me as a speaker and a singer, being told you're going to lose your voice is death-like. I'm not minimizing when people are really told you have a terminal diagnosis, but it's about as close to a death-like experience as I ever want to get, you know, this young anyway. So
massively life-changing, isn't it?
Yeah, massively.
It's interesting the way you say about that, about the how it kind of reset you to look at things and kind of something you couldn't barrel through that typically probably wasn't serving you that well when you've just barreled on through something. And some of us can be determined and my audience, I'm sure we've been in that situation where we've been delivering projects and you just, it's got to get it over the line. You've just, through the sheer force of will and carrying PCs and whatever to get it over the line. And in hindsight, you'll sit back and look at it and go, actually, we shouldn't have done that. Perhaps we should have stopped, reset and done something different. And it reminded me, I don't know whether you get it, there's a TV show in the UK with a guy who's a guy called Wim Hof, who is the Iceman. I don't know, you've nodded on that. So
oh, yeah.
I'm sure you've heard of it. So they did a show with a bunch of UK celebrities recently, and they had, I've forgotten his blooming name, footballer, he used to play for Manchester, Patrice Evra, brilliant footballer. And He was one of these guys. There was one section where they were sitting in the ice, in the cold water, just in their swimming gear. And it was like the last one in wins or whatever it was. And the others all gave up after 2 or 3 minutes. And he wouldn't give up. I mean, you're saying about barreling on through. He just wasn't. He was there. No, I'm not going up. I'm not going. And his core temperature, the thing, checking the core temperature. His core temperature was down below the safe level to the point where they were. The host, Holly Willoughby, was about to drag him out physically herself, she was saying, because he was that point where he was going to. But it was that mindset of, well, I can just, a lot of background and history of him, of why he was like that. But then the thing that I thought was really interesting is a couple of, I dipped in and out of this show, I kind of watched it through other people in some ways, and there was another section where they would die swimming underneath the ice, so they got holes in the ice and they'd swim from one to the other, and he was struggling through, and he got to one point and he said, no, I said, I'm not going to do it, I'm going to give up. And it was kind of the flip side of psychological and personal development of, he wasn't someone who needed to build up resilience to just keep going. He needed to know when to stop. And that was the thing that he learned. And everyone was absolutely delighted about the fact that he said, it's okay to fail and it's okay not to have succeeded. And it was just what you're saying there just reminds me of that position that you get put into, which was involuntary for you and just made you go, well, okay, now I need to change.
What you're talking about, I think, Nigel, is what's popping into my brain, into my thought process, is the fallacy of sunk cost. So there's that idea of being pot committed that, well, the money's already in there. So
yeah.
And that really applies to this situation. And when we think about failure, I know that for me, it was very tempting to go, well, I said I was going to do this, so I got to do it. I'm committed. And the truth is, no, you don't. If you decide to make a new decision based on new circumstances, that's a new, it's a better decision. In fact, mathematically, you'll hear economists talk about this, that what's the game show called? It was Monty Hall initially here, I think in the U.S. anyway, was it Let's Make a Deal? May not have been Monty Hall, but whoever the person was. And at the end, they generally have three doors, right, or three curtains that you can choose between. And so they say curtain one, curtain two, curtain three. And so you pick one. And then they say, well, all right, you picked that curtain, but now there's two other curtains here. Do you want to pick one of these two curtains? That's a new choice. And an economist would tell you that you should take one of those two new curtains. That's a new choice. But many people say, nah, this is my choice. Excuse me. This is my choice. I'm going to stick with it.
Yeah.
In the context of a game show, you know, who cares? But in the context of our life, you made the decision that you were going to swim under the ice from hole to hole to hole. But then you get to a certain point, you go, I don't care about what's at the end of this. I'm not really committed to the process. Sunk cost fallacy would tell us, well, but I was committed at one previous time, and so I've got to stay in it now. No, make a new decision. Make a better decision, hopefully, is what we're doing. And that, for me, was what the opportunity that I got from losing my voice was, a pause, I think of it as maybe the universe asking me, hey, do you want to make a different decision about how you're spending your days, how you're living your life? And I would have ordinarily said, I'm too busy. I got too many things going on. This is my bed. I'm going to lie in it and sort of move with it. But making that decision, being willing to not call it, I don't call it a failure of a business career. It's one for me. It wasn't working for somebody else as a sales employee or a sales leader. It wasn't for me. Just didn't do it. But I learned a lot from it. And I bet that footballer learned a lot from his both journey in the ice bath and journey swimming under the ice.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's quite, as you say, it's not necessarily a failure, and it's failures an interesting phrase I've got written on my wall here. It says fail fast, learn quick. A kind of a little bit of the agile mantra kind of things. I talked to my daughters about the fact that you've got to fail. Because and I did like something. It's one of these tweet things where it's, FAIL stands for first action in learning,
or something like that. Someone took it as an acronym, which I really like because it myself, I as a sport, I do judo, and you learn how to fail in judo, because it doesn't matter how good you are, you will always come up against someone who's better, or just you're not concentrating and they're lucky. And it's all about getting back up, carrying on and doing it, but accepting the failure as part of what it is, which is learning something. It's feedback, isn't it? It's a feedback loop on life. And anything that you don't succeed in, there's something in there, even if it's, I shouldn't have started that in the first place, that you learn about. And I think within the project space as well, I think there's a, I hear stuff about 70% of projects fail, but how many of those projects shouldn't have even got as far as they did because they weren't serving the business, they weren't the right scope. Life changed, as you say, things alter from a priority point of view. You draw the pandemic into it, you can have businesses, someone might, and I did see something on the Britons, the equivalent of Shark Tank in America, the Dragon's Den over here. They had some guys who, I can't for the life of me think what the two businesses were. I think actually it may have been the second one, may have been around hand cleanser and hand sanitizer business, but they pivoted from one business that was completely customer facing, I might have even been food and drink sort of thing, and then completely change their business to suit the what's going on there. In a smaller business, you can do that. Bigger business is harder to do. But again, with projects, sometimes as a project manager, we get target obsessed on the fact that we've got to hit the time, cost, quality. But actually, the whole point of that time, cost, quality is the benefit it delivers afterwards. And it's the benefit that's the important thing we should focus on. And sometimes, and similar to in, like, say, your career's life, you could achieve all those metrics, but actually, if what you want, the fact that you succeeded, doesn't matter one way or the other if it's not going in the direction you want to go.
Yeah, there's a simple question that I use with my clients, and it seems relevant here based on what we're discussing. And it's a question that actually starts out as a statement, but an unfinished statement. And the statement is, which will allow me to blank? Now, here's why I say it's a question. Because what I ultimately want to know is why. Yeah. Why are we doing this? But why is such a confrontational question? It's often not really productive, especially in like cross-divisional or cross-functional meetings. Why it's sort of seen as a threat to status or a threat to authority. So using the phrase, which will allow me or which will allow us to, and then sort of fill in the blank, if you will, creates a lot of learning opportunity for us in a process. So, you know, we're going to hit these time, cost, quality metrics, which will allow us to blank. What's the answer? And then that's going to produce another line of which will allow us to blank. So hit our time, cost, quality, which will allow us to keep the boss happy. I don't know what the answer is, but we want to keep the boss happy, which will allow us to keep our jobs. All right, so really what I've just learned, Nigel, is that you don't give a damn about the time, cost, quality. All you're trying to do is keep your job. Yeah. Now at least we have an honest goal, and there's probably more, you know, keeping my job will allow me to feed my family. Okay, so you don't need this job, you need a job, right? Let's be honest, if you, all you want to do is feed your family, who cares about the TCQ? You just need income. So when we get to, and that helps us get to what I call a root goal. And when we get to the root goal, we can actually assess, is what I'm doing helping me get to what I really care about? In the case of your footballer, probably not. Swimming through the ice didn't get him to what he really cared about. We don't know what he really cared about, but we can tell because he decided that this was no longer a path he wanted to go down. To your point about projects, asking these questions earlier on in the planning process, in the scoping process, you know, the purpose of this project is to blank, which will allow us to what? If we find out that what, maybe we don't even need this project. So to your point, 70% of failure rate, you know, that's debatable, right? Some say that a lot of failures aren't reported, so it should be higher at like 80, but that failure rate can change. But more importantly, the fulfillment rate can change for the people involved in these projects, because what is more demoralizing, disheartening, and spending time working on a project that we all know we're spinning our wheels on. We all know is not really serving the goals, but somebody upstairs signed a check and we're pot committed, so we got to do it. No, we don't. In fact, I believe we shouldn't.
Yeah, I agree. I love that. I love that phrase that you use there, which will allow me to. No, just I've got a note there of the timing of that, so I can pull that out for the exit when I'm sending it social media job. But yeah, because it's the four-year-old, isn't it? Can I have some sweets, Mum? No. Why? Well, because of the why? And eventually, quite often as a parent, you'll go, because I say so. But why just, and it takes a long time to get to that why. And I was in my business analyst training that I had many, many years ago. It was about asking, right, we do this. Well, why do you do that? And it's, well, we do it because this. Oh, but why does that happen? And it's the same thing in a softer way, isn't it, of being able to do this. And it's actually really, I think, a really good introspective way of doing it, which will allow me to, if you're looking at your career, if you're thinking about what your own personal things are about, if you're all sat in a room, is why are we doing this, which will allow me, and you can all go through that and that process of understanding, but having to go all the way to the bottom of it. I really like that. It's really interesting.
And you can apply it to other things in life. I mean, I remember at one point, I wasn't ready to start this business. I was in the planning phase of making the shift, but I wasn't ready. I had a rough week, a real rough week in my day job. And I remember thinking, I'm going to go in on Monday and dramatically and ceremoniously quit. I'm just going to quit. I thought, man, what's that going to do for me? Like, so I'm going to quit, which will allow me to what? And as I thought about that, I realized that I wanted to feel like I was in charge.
It's control, isn't it?
It was control. I wanted to quit because it was my way of asserting control. But what happens after we quit? I would be not only less in control, but I would be less well-resourced. So it was a very emotional decision. And so we can apply this question not only in professional, but in personal circumstances too. You know, decisions. I want to buy this home. I want to buy a new car. I want to find a new spouse. I want to get rid of my current spouse. You know, whatever decisions we're going through in life, this type of development. You know, we were talking pre-show and you talked about soft skill development. I like to think of development in two ways within business, the opportunity that businesses have to develop their people. One, and where we currently spend most of our money, there's $300 billion a year spent by the global business community on training and development. 98% of that is spent on operational development, job-specific training, get better at the job you're in, skills you're going to use operationally in the job that you're in. Only 2% of it is spent on what I call aspirational training. And here in the US, there's a slogan that was used by the United States Army for about 20 something years. It was the longest tenured slogan that they ever used. And the slogan was "Be all you can be." That's an aspirational slogan. And at the top of Maslow's pyramid, when we talk about human needs, is self-actualization. Put another way, becoming all we are capable of becoming. Yeah. So when we look at where the business community spends its time and its money developing its people, it's not in service of them becoming all that they're capable of becoming. It's about them becoming a little bit more efficient in what they're already doing. And the statistics coming out of all sorts of labor agencies around the world tell us that most people aren't that excited about what they're currently doing. That's why we saw the Great Reset and the Great Resignation. But many people don't believe or don't actually have the skills to make a transition. Some of them haven't identified what it is they even want to transition to. I was in that cohort. I had no idea what I wanted to do. I just knew I didn't like what I was doing. That, you're talking about little kids. Like, isn't that the thing? Mom, I'm bored. All right, what do you want to do? I don't know. How am I supposed to help you?
Yeah, it's absolutely right. It draws that that base thing, doesn't it, on that is that it's really funny because the conversation I had with another guest earlier today, he's got a book about called The Career Toolkit, and it talks about those soft skills, as a lot of people talk about them, that what I see as the fundamental skills, those are the base. If you can be brilliant at something, but if you can't play nicely with other humans or efficiently with other humans, being really good at something isn't a lot of use for most people. You get the some of the brilliant jerks out there that can get away with it and kind of through sheer force of will be brilliant at what they're doing and be able to force through. But if you are not a good communicator, if you're not a good negotiator, if you're not someone who can time manage properly, do you know what I mean? All those I still think of kind of base things. They're not about doing the job. They're about how you do the job. And that's the thing is the bit where we can really leverage our people and ourselves.
Well, and it's hard because our entire life, it seems right now, is built up around getting to the next part of life. So if you're in school, right, whether it's at the elementary level or at the collegiate level, most students aren't necessarily interested in learning. They're interested in learning what they need to know to pass the test, to get the grade, to get to the next level, to pass the test, to get to the next exam, to get to the next form, to graduate, to get the job, to get the next job. It's all about the next thing, and we're never really enjoying or intentionally growing from what we're doing right now. And so to call it a fundamental skill, I think is true, but also pointing out something very sad, that we don't spend intentional time as a global society developing those foundational skills. We brush right past them and say, don't worry about learning and remembering all that stuff. Just learn it long enough to pass the test, and then you'll have new stuff to learn next year.
It's just and I can kind of understand the education system in some ways, but it doesn't. And I listened to Seth Godin a few times talking about his views on the school system, obviously the American one mainly, but it is about the school system's about teaching you how to pass a test. It's not about teaching and giving you some basic grounding in skills, but actually the goal is to pass the test and to pass the test at a higher level as set by the government organizations, so that business can quickly and easily sift you when they look at a CV. So they can go there and go, right, they're at that grade. Oh, that's fine. We'll have them. No, we won't have those. It makes it quicker, easier. It doesn't actually make it right. It makes it quicker and easier. That what they get is a bunch of people who know how to revise and pass for a test. They don't necessarily know people who can apply those tools and techniques. And I know that with some of the stuff with my girls going through, I've got a 15-year-old and a 10-year-old, and they're going through this process. And I've seen with my eldest, who was really good, she's a very good artist, she's really good at drawing, really good at anything art wise. She went into secondary school, lots of study of art history, lots of things of different techniques and tools, and less about the creativity, and turned her off to it completely. Within 6 months of being there, that was her least favorite subject. Whereas prior to that, you couldn't stop her drawing something just for fun. And fortunately, she still does, and she will pick it back up, I'm sure. But the system seems to kind of push you. They don't keep that passion, that love, and that interest in these topics that they have. I recognize it's hard to do it and fit it all in. But again, if you've got a kid who's good into music, they love the music, there will be a level of creativity in there. But the music's a hard one because it takes a long time, doesn't it, to learn those basics in order to then really start being creative. But even so, the music doesn't teach you anything about super creative as part of that process. And playing music, being creative with your own music is whilst I wouldn't say I'm any good at it, I do like messing around on a guitar and just with a few vocals on my own. And I find great pleasure and great relaxation doing that.
But well, it's its own language.
Yeah.
Music is a language. That's what I think sets folks who study music apart from others, is that even from a young age, You don't know Mandarin. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. You don't know Spanish. Maybe you do, maybe you don't. But if you've taken piano lessons, you know music. And that's a language. It's a different way of thinking about organizing and synthesizing symbols. You know, like A, B, C, D, E, F, G are nothing more than symbols. We call them letters, but they're symbols. Just like back in the day, you know, pre-linguistic society just used drawings. And that's how we all, you know, communicated. Musical notes are symbols. That staff is just like a sentence. So music has sentences, it has paragraphs. We call them different things because in the language of music, we have different terms for them. You know, in the English language, it's a sentence, it's a paragraph. And so understanding that language opens up different neural pathways, creates different neural pathways in the brain, and opens up the opportunity to process experiences in a different way. That's really all intelligence is data points. The more data points you and I have to link and correlate an experience, the more intelligent we are. So that's why there are some people that I admire who have sayings like, if you can see it, you can be it. If you can understand how it operates, if you can see it, whether it's in your mind or in reality, if you can envision it, you're closer to being able to do it. That's a really, really important concept. And so that's why young students are taken to see masters perform on the piano or on the oboe or the cello or whatever. They're exposed to people who are performing at such a high level that they say, oh, I see how that's done. I can do that now. I've seen another human being. It's not just an MP3 file that I'm listening to. There's a real person making that.
Yeah.
It's much more tangible. That's why I think, you know, in the project management world, mentorship is so important because you can see how someone who's more tenured has done it. Even though the material's laid out in front of you, even though the reference material, the coursework is all there to become more skilled and to gain advanced designation, you want to see someone else doing it. And that, I think, opportunity, whether you're an artist, a musician, a poet, you know, no matter what art you practice, you're opening up that creative vein that you talked about that's so critical.
I'm sure you loved that first part of the chat with Greg, and the second part's next week. So whatever you're doing, have a fantastic week. Bye now. So this is my final wrap up. Every week you're going to hear this, you're going to get bored of it, but you can always click next podcast if so. If you have enjoyed it, if you've listened to this podcast, the end of this show, and you think that was great, I'd love to be able to help Nige out. There are loads of ways you can do it. The first and obvious way is to share the podcast. Send it out to people. If you know colleagues and friends who'd benefit from it, you think they'd enjoy it, just send them the link. Grab one of the links, send them to www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. That's www.nigelcreaser.com/podcasts. And that will push them over to a Linktree link, and it's got all of the different ways they can consume the podcast. If you are feeling generous and have a big bag of cash, you could grab a copy of one of my books. Obviously, they're available in all the usual places, and print and digital. Again, jump on the website, www.nigelcreaser.com/shop, and that will give you a list of all the different ways that you can contribute and grab copies of the book. Also got links to all my guests' books on there as well, where I get a little bit of a kickback from them. If you are of a sporting mind, I have a number through doing some of my judo and running antics. I've managed to secure a few affiliate links and affiliates there as well. So in there, somewhere in the sponsors page, there's links to those as well. So clicking onto those and grabbing if you're looking to get super fit, then that would be fabulous as well. And I get a little kickback from those. I have a Patreon account. It's patreon.com/SundayLunchPM. So again, you can ping something in there, buy me a coffee or whatever. And finally, obviously the most important is coming back, listen again, because the more of you that come back, the more visibility I get, because there's more times that it's downloaded and all the SEO works and things like that. So yeah, that's it. So if you can help me out, I would be much appreciated. If you can't, don't worry about it. Thank you very much. Cheers now. Bye.
Well, it's goodbye from me, Nigel Creaser, and it's goodbye from him, the Sunday Lunch PM. Goodbye.